Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, January 12th of the year 2018. How is it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's back with you here for part two of our year in review for the past 12 months as we look back at the year 2017 and some of the other smaller stories that you might have missed and forgotten about that are still noteworthy and still worth discussing, enjoying or reliving and enjoying through the memory of them. And we'll also take time in this program as well to just kind of take a bit of a look ahead to some of the games that 2018 will have in store for us. So we will get back to business as usual and catching up on all the latest and greatest video game news on next week's program. But this is our traditional, our annual second part of Year in Review specials.
Indeed, I am always the second voice on this program, and this week I'm Dennis, the reformed caffeine addict.
Hi, Dennis.
Yes, I'm Dennis, and I'm a caffeine addict.
Well, congratulations on kicking your coffee habit.
Yes, it was actually not easy. I wanted to say that jokingly, but it's dead serious. It was something I wanted to try to do for a while and, just to see how things go for a while. And I think I managed to get out of the danger zones with all of the headaches and everything. With only.
So you've been weaning yourself off and the physical aspect of the dependency seems to have subsided.
Yeah, well, I did kind of go cold turkey except for, a couple of times when I got really bad headaches and I just had to have a small cup of coffee and then the headache went away and then don't drink coffee until another headache and now there's no more headaches. So, I'm going to take that as a win.
Excellent. How long did you give yourself to kind of, hunker down and break this curse that the brownest of brown liquors have on you?
Well, it's been kind of like a 2-week thing so far, and I think I'm out of the worst of it now, so I think I can just kind of call it at this point. It took me 2 weeks to stop drinking coffee, and I've replaced it with drinking way too much water, which is probably not a bad thing.
Well, it can be if you're not flushing it out.
Well, I definitely am.
Excellent. Then you're fine.
Though according to the internet, I'm still not drinking enough water, despite the fact that I'm drinking like 3 liters. But yeah, the internet says
according to the internet, nothing's ever good enough for it.
No, the internet's like, oh, you need to drink. It's like, well, males between the ages of blah and blah need to drink 103 or 109 ounces of water a day. I'm like, huh, that's a lot of water. That's literally almost 4 liters of water.
That seems almost unwieldy.
Yeah.
Like, at that point, it seems like you're becoming a slave to water because you're either going to get more water, drinking the water, or flushing out the water, and then going to get more water.
Yeah, but, well, here we are.
How does anybody get any work done?
They don't. They're constantly in a state of drinking or urinating or going to get water to drink.
I see.
That becomes so the work.
It's more to avoid the work you're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. I'm replacing my job as a software developer with one as a software developer who drinks a lot of water. That's my job now.
Software developer by day, water drinker by all day.
Yes. Exactly. but yeah,
So how long are you going to give yourself in this new coffee-free era before you ever entertain the idea or ever having, like, an after-dinner coffee or anything of that nature?
I don't know. I haven't really put much thought into that.
Okay.
I'm going to say a year.
Wow. Okay. Mark it down, folks. Here we are on this week's edition of the program for the week of Friday, January 12th, 2018, when the one Mr. Dennis has made the proclamation he's going to go a year between cups of coffee.
Yes. Yes, I will.
All right. More power to you. All the best in your aspirations to be coffee-free for an entire calendar year.
Or I should maybe say caffeine-free. That's what I'll say. Caffeine free.
Okay. So that's affecting more beverages.
Yeah, I'll try my best to be caffeine free anyways. I mean, I might have a Coca-Cola here and there or something like that, but.
You monster.
But I'm not going to have like, you know, the 3+ cups of coffee a day like I was having.
Which even that is a moderate amount considering what you got up to at various points.
Yeah. Me and one of my siblings at one point were, when we were both in college and living at home with our parents, I think it was not uncommon for the coffee maker to brew 4 pots in a day. Maybe more than that between the two of us.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of coffee.
Yep. Sure was. Sure was.
That almost becomes like a full-time job of drinking the coffee, making the coffee, going to get the coffee, flushing out the coffee. You become addicted and just a slave to the coffee at that point.
Oh, I used to take like a couple of thermoses with me to work. One was like one of those like 1.5 liter ones. Then I had a smaller one that was like, I think another additional cup. I was basically drinking 2 liters of coffee a day at one point, pretty regularly. And felt great about it, but now I'm not 20 years old anymore and I don't feel great about it, so time to stop. And, yeah.
Well, congratulations on doing it under your own willpower. I assume you didn't need a sponsor, or any sort of active support group around you. You just did it through your own sheer force of will made it happen.
That's right.
And hopefully you are able to keep this up for the next calendar year. If not, I can only assume that the public will demand you be flogged accordingly.
Well, the public is a bunch of jerks. But, yeah.
Don't worry, public. I will carry out your will.
Okay, great. anyways, back... But getting back into the more important aspect of this show, which is us talking about things that are not me and my caffeine addiction / relapse.
It'll make for a great chapter in your autobiography. Compelling, gripping story.
Or just like, you know, one chapter. It's like, well, that sucked. Next chapter.
How do you call this chapter? It was literally just a sentence.
Well, I can call whatever I want a chapter. That was just a chapter.
But before we go fully off the rails, because we're close, we're teetering on the edge here. As I said off the top, this is the second part of our 2017 year in review. Last week we focused on the big three: Sony, Nintendo, and Microsoft, as well as other aspects of the gaming world, but we focus on the smaller stories that we may have missed from 2017 and that you may have forgotten about entirely. And we've broken up into a couple categories, and we'll focus on actually one of the bigger recurring themes that we found ourselves talking about in 2017, that being not just esports, but the continued push of esports and purveyors of esports into the North American marketplace.
Yeah, esports really feels like it hit its stride in 2017 in the mainstream. It's not fully mainstream yet, but all of the groundwork started to get laid in 2017 by a bunch of major players to kind of try to get esports into the hearts and minds of the average person who might not have necessarily have been into esports. yeah, lots and lots of things happened in 2017 to that effect.
And a lot of well-heeled individuals trying to push esports into mainstream acceptance in North America, as well as some non-traditional players, for lack of a better term, business people getting involved with esports, which a couple years ago we likely didn't think we would ever see, but here we are. The year started off actually pretty early on with the NBA of all entities making the announcement that they would work alongside 2K Games to produce the NBA 2K E-League. So the NBA would be getting in on esports action with its own branch of competition.
Yeah, and doing it maybe in a way that makes the most sense to traditional sports people, maybe in a way of bringing traditional sports people in a way that they understand, because instead of letting players make their own teams with crazy internet handle type names, they actually just basically said, no, we're going to run it like the NBA. We're going to have, you know, parallel teams to real NBA teams and have it that way. So you're going to have like your Chicago Bulls esports team. You're going to have your, like Jazz, your other, I don't know why those are the first two teams that popped into my head for NBA. I'm clearly not a basketball fan. I'm sorry. Charlotte Hornets. There's another one. There we go. Okay. I was floundering there, but I brought it right back for a second.
You sure did. And you mentioned the two teams that made it to the 1997 NBA Finals. as well as a team that once existed, went under, and then kind of came back a couple years ago. So it's all come full circle with your NBA knowledge.
Perfect. The Cavs, that's another one, right?
It sure is, yes.
The Toronto Raptors, are they still a thing?
Ooh, yes, they are.
Okay, good. Well, I don't know if all of those teams are necessarily getting esports franchises, but a lot of them are going to be getting esports franchises. That was announced in February, which is kind of bringing like a more traditional sports type model to esports in the minds of like fans and stuff, I feel is a good step towards making it easier for people to follow at the very least.
I'd say so. And I think that's been one of the, big hangups, big factors in, perhaps inhibiting esports growth in North America. Not to say it hasn't grown, which it certainly has, but, your casual mainstream viewer, your more traditional sports fan aren't inclined to maybe pay attention or divert attention away from their modern sports league, NBA, NHL, Major League Baseball, or NFL, because it's harder to follow. You have these teams that are just, entirely non-traditional, hard to follow, maybe hard to understand team names. Each player has their own unique internet handle to them. Those can be off-putting for someone who aren't familiar with that world and are just kind of tuning in casually, but NBA instead trying to leverage their property and their fan base into the world of esports. And at the time we spoke of it, the announcement last February, and still holds true to this point, a genius move on the part of the NBA because of the crossover with the major NBA demographic, which is young adult males, and also the world of esports, where the primary demographic is young adult males. So if you have this demographic that's also going to be into esports, why not get them into your esports?
Yeah, exactly. Because we know there's a lot of different choices for esports out there. And but of course, NBA were not the only ones to make bigger overtures. A lot of different overtures in esports were made in 2017. The NRG esports team got a pretty crazy sponsor in March in the city of Washington, D.C. The whole city was sponsoring an esports team.
Yes. It is the nation's capital of the United States of America, but it's not as though this is an act of the federal government. It's more the tourism branch of the city itself that was engaging in this.
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, other things also on a similarly official type scale happened, because esports was officially added as a medal event for the 2022 Asian Games, which might be more impressive than a city sponsoring an esports team.
It's a level of acceptance, I don't know if we ever would have thought possible a couple of years ago to have, major amateur athletic body, accept esports in the same way they accept gymnastics or weightlifting or volleyball or just common medal events for sports. And so, for the 2018 edition of the Asian Games, esports will just be a demonstration event, so basically a trial balloon to see how it goes, but it will officially become a medal event at the 2022 event, and how perfect, that will certainly help the growth of esports, because the 2022 Asian Games are set to be held in the city of Hangzhou, China, and the Asian Games are a regional event for Asian region countries, similar to the Pan Am Games.
Yeah, it's like the Pan Am Games we have here in North America. But, that happened in April, but in May, it was revealed who the 17 NBA teams were, so now I no longer have to flounder, because we have these notes written up, and it was just on the next page that I didn't see yet. but yeah, just in case you were wondering, and you want to hear me not rattling NBA teams off the top of my head. The Boston Celtics, Cleveland Cavaliers, Dallas Mavericks, Detroit Pistons, Golden State Warriors, Indiana Pacers, Memphis Grizzlies, Miami Heat, Milwaukee Bucks, New York Knicks, Orlando Magic, Philadelphia 76ers, Portland Trailblazers, Sacramento Kings, Toronto Raptors, Utah Jazz, and the Washington Wizards. So that's all of these 17 NBA teams, signing on for the NBA Esports League.
And so how that would work is there would be basically a representative player for that E-League franchise. So there'd be someone representing the Toronto Raptors in the NBA 2K E-League, and they would be playing the game, but they would be using and controlling their own create-a-player characters, as opposed to, you know, getting a beneficial effect from being the one to play as the Cleveland Cavaliers, because it has LeBron James, or the team has LeBron James, and you'd be playing as LeBron James, the best character in the game.
Yeah.
So that would level the playing field, which is certainly nice. And in your initial floundering, you got two of the...
I got two of the 17, and I listed off a couple others that are not. But
No. The Chicago Bulls were not, nor were the Charlotte Hornets.
No. But they are still teams, so
go me. What wasn't for a couple of years?
I'm assuming that was the Charlotte Hornets.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, all right. But
it all came back around. And another aspect we saw of esports in 2017 was the growth of esports broadcasts and a number of partnerships being linked up. We saw... actually Twitch really get into the official side of streaming events, striking a deal with Bandai Namco to create their own esports league, this one focused on Tekken 7. It's a multi-year partnership forge the creation of the Tekken World Tour. So it's saw a number of events throughout the year with a prize pool of $200,000 for a 6-month long season, and the partnership granted Twitch the exclusive broadcast rights to all these world tour events.
But so, that wasn't the only company that Twitch signed a deal with. They also signed a deal with Blizzard in June for a 2-year exclusive deal for streaming esports events, which is a big one, because Blizzard has a lot of esports events, including ones for Hearthstone, Heroes of the Storm, World of Warcraft, StarCraft II, and Overwatch. That's, yeah, apparently it's going to cover 20 events over, like through 2018, and I think into 2019 a little bit.
I believe so. And just this week with the official launch of the, of games in the regular season for the Overwatch League, which we'll just touch on in a moment, it was reported in several corners that, Twitch's deal with Blizzard for the 2-year period to broadcast these events, including the Overwatch League, was to the tune of $90 million, making it the richest broadcast contract for an esports league to date.
Yeah, which is nothing to sneeze at. But Twitch wasn't the only broadcaster trying to get into esports either. We saw the more traditional side of things with TBS wanting to... well, TBS was making a bit of a push, I should say, in 2017 as well. They were seeing what Twitch was doing and went, wait a minute, we're a TV station. We have people watching us already. Why don't we do this as well?
They did, and they formed their E-League, their Friday night broadcast of esports on the station, but they expanded it to include a new tournament focused solely on Injustice 2, the DC Comics fighter from NetherRealm Studios. And that one saw a prize pool of $250,000 that ran weekly and actually was the fourth series, the fourth game-focused tournament of the E-League, following previous ones of Counter-Strike Global Offensive, Overwatch, and Street Fighter V. And actually, the E-League itself on TBS initially launched in 2016, but they continued to expand it, and I guess they've been doing enough in terms of ratings and outside traditional broadcast avenue exposure to keep it going. And as I've said before, it's a low cost to produce these things.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, it's just a couple of cameras, and I mean, all the traditional camera work and stuff that you would need to do is kind of not even comparable to what you would need to do for a sports broadcast. But that's, I think, the thinking also that went into some of these other traditional networks picking up esports things and wanting to broadcast them as well. Because we also saw NBC and ESPN both trying to dip their feet in as well. NBC wanted to, well, did televise some Rocket League stuff over the summer. But then also on the Rocket League topic, some Rocket League was broadcast during the Summer X Games as well, which was good for them. Good for everyone involved.
As Rocket League trying to get its foot solidly planted into the earth of esports here in North America, ESPN this summer as well continued, or not continued, but once again aired the finals of the Street Fighter V tournament from EVO in July. And to have these events and show them during the summertime actually makes a lot of sense on the part of ESPN, simply because that's a dry time. All that you really have for professional sports going on is Major League Baseball. And that's a couple nights a week. You still need other content. You know, hockey's done for the year. Basketball's done for the year. There's off-season stuff you can talk about. But it's still another month before the NFL training camps open up, so they need content, and they need stuff to fill their hours of broadcast with, and hell, why not try and attract a another demographic, a non-traditional demographic, for a pittance compared to what you pay for all these other big contracts. But if we're talking about non-traditional broadcasters get in on the esports game, then we also have to talk about the fact that this year actually saw Disney XD broadcast a sporting tournament.
That wasn't even the one I was going to mention either. The one going to mention was the BBC. I mean, in a way, like, Disney XD makes a little bit more sense because, you know, they're like, it's kind of like the youth focused arm of Disney fine. But the BBC, you don't traditionally think of as something like youth focused. It's kind of like a stodgy old British institution, kind of like, you know, the CBC in Canada, where, you know, on occasion they'll get younger kind of programming, but a lot of the times it's just, it skews to an older demographic. But no, I guess BBC was probably thinking the same thing that a lot of these companies were thinking, and that it's cheap to produce esports. And, you know, if they have dead periods, like a 4-hour block sometime during the weekend, they would just kind of slot in some stuff. And that's what the BBC was doing, or decided to do, where they would air some Street Fighter V, CSGO, and Rocket League matches for 4 hours a weekend.
From the
Gfinity Elite League Series 1.
Yes, and as I was saying before that, Disney XD, that one, as you said, yes, the youth-focused arm, but they were broadcasting something, something else you didn't see being broadcast, or with the level of popularity or engagement as some other games have in esports, but they were broadcasting the Evo finals of Super Smash Brothers from Las Vegas as well. Actually, those were broadcast not just on Disney XD, but on ESPNU as well, which is the collegiate-focused arm of the ESPN broadcast family. And they were actually doing it as a simulcast. So you have Disney XD, which basically I think is a station primarily focused on, you know, 12-year-old boys, and ESPNU, which is 22-year-old boys, showing the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which is kind of wild. Also, it was Super Smash Brothers. That's, I mean, it's a smaller potato comparatively, but
apparently,
still neat that Nintendo got in there.
Apparently, that's not necessarily true, though. I mean, I was, you know, talking to one of my coworkers who actually went to Evo and competed for, I believe it was Blaze Blue, but also Guilty Gear. But like, he was saying, no, like the Smash community is actually huge. It's almost as big as the Street Fighter community.
Really?
Yeah. So, take that for what it's worth, but Smash Brothers is huge, but obviously Street Fighter is the biggest.
Yes, it is. And, I can understand why ESPNU and Disney XD would both be broadcasting it, because it appeals to both those demographics.
Yeah. And it's kind of wild. That's, I think, one of the other things about video games too, just as a brief aside, competitive gaming does kind of have a bit more of a cross-generational appeal, because younger kids like video games maybe more than they like sports.
And that's actually a growing trend, and I'm sure a motivator for the NBA to have launched their own esports league, is that younger generations aren't as devoted, aren't as ardent in their following of the major sports leagues. The average age for fans is all older. I think it's in the 50s for each of the four major professional sports leagues, and younger people just aren't coming to them in the numbers that they previously used to, in no small part because there's the option of esports waiting for them too.
Yeah.
But the big thing we certainly have to talk about, the big, I guess, megaton bomb that, so to speak, in the world of esports that went off was an announcement from July, which was really the hotbed period of esports news throughout the course of the calendar year. But the announcement, and really confirmation of what had been rumored and believed and speculated for a number of months leading up to it, that Activision Blizzard would get into the esports business officially by launching the Overwatch League. And that's exactly what they did. And this is really what crystallized the different approach that we saw the NBA 2K League taking, and I'm sure we'll see other esports startup leagues taking as well. But abandoning the team approach that Hearthstone and some other sports or esports leagues have, and going with a more traditional North American style franchise model of a league where you basically sell memberships into the league to really rich people, and then those rich people are responsible for those teams. And that's what we saw. And this is when we saw the well-heeled, non-traditional esports people get involved in the business.
Yeah. A lot of different people, including, people from a wide dearth of walks of life, really. You saw Jeff Wilpon, who is the co-founder and partner at Sterling VC, who he owns the New York Mets, can operate the New York team. That kind of makes sense. You saw another owner in Robert Kraft, who owns the New England Patriots. But you also saw, people in other cities, just people maybe from other walks of life, like the Seoul, Korea owner, Kevin Chu from Kabam, among other people. Not necessarily even sports people, like Kabam is a software development company. Certainly a lot of these people are kind of connected with, gaming at some point. Like, the owner of Shanghai was the NetEase company. San Francisco is Energy Esports. Miami Orlando was Misfits Gaming. Los Angeles was the Immortals. These are all sort of like esports or, software development companies, but they're all like successful business people too, which is, it's not just like fly by night, whatever. Like the cost was actually kind of high to buy a team in the Overwatch League, from what I understand.
Yeah, it wasn't officially ever declared how much a franchise fee was, though it was widely suspected and believed to be in the $10 million range, which someone like Jeff Wilpon or Robert Kraft being a billionaire, could just easily afford. And if this is a growth opportunity for something in North America, then it's easier to get in on the ground floor than buy it later. And the real way they'll make their money back, of course, is through the growth of esports in North America, and then also that increasing the value of their franchises, which they'll turn around and sell later on for potentially hundreds of millions of dollars, because that's how sports works.
Indeed.
But the unique approach we saw the Overwatch League take, not just in its franchise model, but also came in its team structure as well, because though it's a North American-based league and a primarily North American-based league, it also has teams across the globe. That, as you mentioned in your talking there, there's a team based in Seoul. There's a team also based in Shanghai. There's also a team based in London. And none of the four major North American sports leagues can say that they have teams across the pond in either direction.
No, they can't. But, it's, esports had a good year in 2017, I'd say.
It did, and, another fact of, the Overwatch League kind of stepping out and doing things a bit differently and more traditional, North American style that I think is worth mentioning is the change to the compensation structure and treating them more as employees with, more defined, benefits, minimum salaries and things of that nature. And it's also a move we saw taken by, League of Legends, which, radically changed its, players' compensation and hell, its entire, league structure back in June as well, going, opting for a $10 million buy-in for teams in that league as well, as it, as Riot Games just entirely rethought the, model of the League of Legends, North American League Championship Series. No doubt spurred and motivated by the fact the Overwatch League was coming down the pipeline with very similar, aspects of its league, and so Riot Games wanting the League of Legends series to be very similar, but at least if you're a League of Legends player in the championship series, you have a union as well, because back on June 15th, as part of the restructuring, Riot Games basically, well, it's not a union, per se, it's a players association. So I guess there's some legal difference between them. I don't know what it is, but on June 15th, the first head of the, North American, I guess, League of Legends Players Association head was named, and that man is Hal Biegas, who is the former assistant general counsel from the NBA Players Association. And so he will be there, and he's well versed in, I guess, professional sports business, having spent 13 years at the NBA Players Association, formed his own media group along with some other people, and he also worked in the sports management business where he was a representative for former NBA star Jason Kidd. So, hell, he even started his own sports management firm called Sideline Sports Management. So he knows the ins and outs, and if esports in North America are going more towards this model, then you want people well-versed in the North American sports business model to act on your behalf.
Absolutely. I guess there were a few other minor things surrounding esports as well. I mean, more minor leagues announced, F1, Formula One launching an esports series, back in August to coincide with the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix in November. CD Projekt Red announcing their Gwent Masters tournament series. Yeah, lots of different, things like that. But, basically, I feel like we could probably just leave the esports thing at esports. Gotta hit the ground running quite a lot in 2017.
It did. It set the table and, I guess laid the foundation for the, what I can assume and imagine will be a phenomenal year, for growth of esports in North America. Just this week, again, the regular season, the inaugural regular season of the Overwatch League, kicking off this week with a number of games actually this past Wednesday, which were seen on Twitch, and they all emanated out of the brand new, Overwatch or Blizzard facility that was built, in an old TV studio in, I think, Burbank, California, or one of the big studio areas, an old television, production, lot that, Activision or Blizzard bought and turned into basically the home base for the Overwatch League, where the games will be contested from. So in California, makes it easier for their Pacific teams to make it the way over. If you're in London and have to travel that way, then God help you. That's a hellacious journey.
Yes. But
esports, we'll see more of that in 2018. But yeah, 2017 saw a lot of impressive impressive accomplishments, but some less impressive and more silly, and some just made you scratch your head.
Yeah, I was going to say esports was not the only thing that, really continued through in 2017. 2017 saw its fair share of speedrunners outdoing themselves and people being crazy related to video games. Maybe more than I recall in recent memory. Maybe it was just the, a lot of extra full moons that happened last year or something. Speedrunning and weird accomplishments is, I think, the next big topic that we can say that we're going to talk about now.
Yes, the umbrella under which we can get into talking about some other impressive and sometimes weirder stuff from 2017. And there's a push in the speedrunning community to not just beat a game as fast as you can, but in some corners to have some sort of gimmick or some sort of shtick to differentiate your speedrun from everyone else's. And For some people, that's running through games and beating games blindfolded.
Yeah, which you might think, what? And you'd probably be right to think so, but, you know, like most things, certain video games literally are just muscle memory. If you know how long to hold a controller press for, you know how long you might go, you know, as your character. And if you just kind of memorize distances for whatever reason, you can probably do that. As one speedrunner who, went by the handle of Parisian Player, did with Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, they managed to beat Link to the Past blindfolded, beating every boss, getting everything in Link to the Past in under 9 hours, just over 9 hours, which, I don't think I could do not blindfolded.
A 9 hour speed run through Legend of Zelda Link to the Past and you're blindfolded. I'm as flabbergasted by this now as I was basically a year ago. The amount of work and time and effort put into training and preparing yourself and rehearsing and practicing through the game, before you ever make your attempt at a speed run. I cannot imagine what that would have been like, how much time went into it, how much, how long you had to prepare for, and, the environment where the speed run had to take place. It's obviously just a casual living room or something of that nature, but you have to have it dead silent just so you can properly hear the game, because the Parisian Player was using bombs almost for echolocation as well, and other things that make, you know, tinks and blasts and whatever to get an idea of where walls would be and basically form a map in their head as to what was happening on the screen because they were blindfolded by a Budweiser scarf.
Yeah. And not only were they blindfolded, but the rest of the conditions of the speed run were a little bit draconian in my opinion. they apparently weren't allowed to get up at all. And yeah, he said he did not eat, drink, or go to the bathroom. And, he's part of a group called the Blindfolded Brotherhood. And the way that the Blindfolded Brotherhood community does this is that, the blindfold must be seen at all time. So going to the bathroom is forbidden. And in this regard, the blindfold speedrun is not just a speedrun challenge, but it's a bit of like a weird, almost like something that like a Buddhist monk might go through or something. Almost like some sort of like training your body as well. Not to say that you should not use the bathroom for 9 hours. That's bad, in my opinion, but, yeah, he did that back in January, and that kind of set the tone for the year, I'd say.
It did, because it was after January that, we kind of saw more people doing some, more gimmicky, sticky things, because the speedrunning community is very large, ever-growing, and you need to stand out somehow. And so one impressive accomplishment that caught our attention came from the end of February when, the Mexican runner, as he calls himself, Mr. Piotr Delgado, Kujaluk, I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, but the Mexican runner, successfully completed his mission to speedrun all 714 NES games that were commercially released. Even some of the illicit ones that were not officially released, but 714 NES games, he beat it and saved Super Mario Brothers 3 for the end one. It took him 3 years to complete this challenge that he had set out for himself, which, if you think about it, is not that long.
No, but that would have been a lot of time spent playing terrible games.
True, and if you recall, there were some games released for the NES that really weren't games. There were no final endpoint to them or anything that you could reach or achieve that would signal completion or success in the game.
Yeah, so I guess there he would have had to have looked in to see what kind of rules surrounding speedruns were for games specifically. He probably had to consult with the internet to see how he would do it. But, yeah, so hats off to Peter Delgado Kuselchuk is how I'm going to say it.
Go for it.
It's probably not right.
Not only did he beat the 714 games that were released for the NES in North America, he also tackled, as part of this challenge, 35 games that were exclusive to PAL territories as well, because he's nothing if not a completionist.
Indeed. But speaking of people who do crazy speedruns, I mean, might as well continue on the speedrun train for a bit. The Twitch streamer Twerking Yoshi did something insane as well by using bananas as controllers. He, of course, this was a custom setup, but he somehow managed to hook bananas up, as controllers, and he managed to beat Dark Souls 3 using these bananas, following his personal, history of beating Dark Souls 3 with weirder games or weirder input methods, including DDR dance pad, steering wheel controller, Donkey Kong bongos, etc. But he beat it with actual bananas using what appeared to be a Makey Makey kit and, dying 62 times in the process.
Now, the thing you and I were impressed by is the fact that it was bananas, but how do you not just smash them into total mush during the course of gameplay?
Yeah, bananas are definitely not one of the more robust fruits. You know, they're... If I was going to throw a fruit to do some damage, a banana is not one of the ones I would use, personally. I mean, my brain goes to apple, maybe an avocado, if that counts as a fruit. I'm not sure.
It's a stone fruit.
Yeah. There's better, more sturdy fruits out there. More sturdy fruit, I should say. But yeah, he did it with bananas, and that was impressive.
And also, too, bananas, I didn't think them to be great conductors of electricity, so these are not the most accurate controllers either.
No, I mean, I don't know. That's not the only Twerking Yoshi achievement either. He also turned his sights on Bloodborne, because if you play Dark Souls, you also play Bloodborne. That's just how it works. But he used a DDR dance pad to defeat Bloodborne as well, which he had apparently never even played it previously. So he just kind of did a first playthrough of Bloodborne using the DDR dance pad, and Twitch saw it, and it was crazy.
Now, I'd imagine somebody like a Twerking Yoshi who puts a lot of time and effort into doing these speed runs, doing these run-throughs even of games using very non-traditional, very handicapping input methods, your just normal gamer skills really have to improve as a result of all the time and effort that you put into them.
Presumably, I would imagine so.
It'd be like, training in extra gravity or something, just that extra layer of adversity and challenge on top of you, on top of what you're already trying to do, and you just get stronger as a result.
That's definitely true. Another user, back in October as well, beat another super hard game using a dance pad. One named Peking Boo, they defeated or went through Cuphead using DDR dance pads as well. Cuphead is, some people were jokingly calling it Cup Souls, which, it's not an easy game from what I understand as well. So
kudos to them. It's the Dark Souls of cartoony old-timey shooters.
Yes. But yeah, other weird handicaps people were putting themselves in. There was Super Mario Odyssey was beaten back in December without jumping.
which is a little crazy considering it's a Mario game and jumping is one of the most integral components of the game.
Yeah. But yeah, it was beaten
and granted the user who did beat it without jumping, capitalized on a lot of technicalities to achieve that as well, but the fact remains they were still able to beat it without jumping, but I don't know if that's as impressive as this next speedrunning accomplishment, which took place on Christmas Day, December 25th, when it's a very difficult task for some people to beat speedrunning records. Now imagine if you are able to beat one of those records, the joy, the ecstasy, the jubilation you would feel in that moment. Now imagine if you were to beat that record a second time in very short order, because that's what happened to Ryan Gibbs, who managed to beat his previous world record speedrun in the runway level of GoldenEye 007 from the N64 with a time of 30 seconds. And yet, a couple hours later, he managed to shave one whole second off his time and set a new benchmark for the third level in the GoldenEye game, the classic GoldenEye game, which, if you don't recall Runaway and why it only takes roughly 30 seconds to beat, it involves you as James Bond running down a mountain road while taking out heavy artillery and grenades so that you can escape in a small airplane from the chemical plant that you have just set to explode.
Yeah. Not one of the longer levels. It's not like the cradle or anything like that, but still, that leaves it sort of a prime candidate to be speedrunned. I don't know what the verb of that is. For you to speedrun. There we go.
Yes.
But
so it's impressive considering that when you play it on the hardest difficulty, I think the benchmark people had been working at was around the 40-second mark for, oh God, since around 2001, and it's been slowly whittled down time after time since then. So, yeah, twice in one day. That's impressive. And those are scenarios where basically anything can just screw up your speed run and you have to restart. So there's a lot of stick-to-itiveness required for that.
Yeah.
More than I possess.
I think the craziest one, though, was just 5 days before Christmas. There was one guy who was trying to speed run 3 Final Fantasy games at the same time, which, using one input, sending the same input to 3 games at the same time, it's probably not going to yield the best results, but yeah, he was trying to do it, and even if he didn't do it, it's the concept alone I think is worth mentioning, because it's such a weird idea.
And it would certainly take some finagling to set up your control structure to have it work on 3 different games. It doesn't strike me as, well, the most ideal scenario, certainly not, nor the most obvious one, I'll say that. And because it's Final Fantasy games, you're inevitably going to get to, say, a battle in one game and yet be maybe at a shop in another thing, or I mean, how does that work if, say, you have 3 battles going on at the same time?
Yeah, I don't know. Regardless, hope he's confident he'll do something, because he does hold, you know, other impressive records for all 3 of the games previously. His records are 3 hours and 39 minutes and 5 seconds for Final Fantasy VII, just shy of 7 hours and 30 minutes for Final Fantasy VIII, and just over 9 hours for Final Fantasy IX, which are all pretty low numbers for RPGs that are 60 plus hours normally to beat, but
can you get down to those numbers?
Absolutely not. But mind you, I also haven't put much time or effort into figuring out how to break the games, but yeah.
Some other aspects, some of the, you know, crazier aspects of gaming in 2017 led to some and hearty numbers. I'm recalling, first of all, from back in January when the the dedicated collector, or as I had termed them when I wrote the RTF, or file name for the RTF document where I saved this story, the crazy person who managed to collect all 1,262 Nintendo Wii games.
Yeah, and you might be thinking, the Wii had 1,262 games, and also, why the Wii? And we're still thinking that, but he did it, and he showed all the pictures of his collection to the Nintendo Age forums, including, you know, a little bit of insight into why. He tried to rationalize it. You know, Wii is a fascinating system, sold over 100 million units, was insane success, blah, blah, blah. It's an interesting challenge, unexplored territory. Not many people have gone for a complete set of Wii games. Fair enough. Fine. I guess there's something to be said about being the first to do something. I mean, you're not climbing Mount Everest, but you're also doing more than I'm doing, so good for you, I suppose.
And part of the challenge is finding some of the most impossible to find games, because there was a lot of shovelware released for the Nintendo Wii, and a lot of titles that you could have easily just passed by in the discount bin of your local retailer, or just maybe never even seen because they didn't get wide releases. Nintendo Tweezer, the user's name, who collected all these Wii games, posted a list of the 40 hardest-to-find Wii games. Topping that list was the 2-for-1 Power Pack Winter Blast / Summer Sports, as well as Maximum Racing Supercarts. Now, you hear those titles, and you might be wondering, what are those games? I don't recall them. That's because nobody knows of them. They were garbage. They were not seen by human eyes. If it weren't for E.T., you know, taking the mantle of being a game buried in a landfill in New Mexico, that's where those games would have been.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Am I being hard on them? No, they're garbage. Everyone who went through that generation of gaming knows there was so much garbage on the Wii.
Yeah, but that's not the only big number for video games that we saw. I guess we also saw, you know, when Breath of the Wild, Legend of Zelda was released. It's a huge game. There's a lot of stuff in the game. And one of the things that are in the game is one of the things you can collect are Korok seeds. You know, you kind of give them to Hestu, the kind of oversized Korok, who uses them in his maracas, and he does a dance, and he expands your inventory with them. But you might be wondering, like, how many of those seeds are there in the game? I've been collecting hundreds of them, and there doesn't seem to be an end to it. Well, it was finally discovered how many there are, and there are 900 in the game. But the funny part was when that number was revealed, it was revealed what the ultimate thing that Hestu gives you at the very end, and it's a big joke. And that joke is that it's a piece of crap. Hestu gives you a big piece of crap.
I mean, it's a golden piece of crap,
which you can sell for money or whatever, I think. But
the fact remains, it's a golden turd. And it isn't specifically stated in the game that it's a piece of crap. It was widely believed. And then ultimately in December at the Game Awards, IGN actually had a chance to catch up with Hidemaru Fujibayashi, the director of Breath of the Wild, who kind of gave a bit more insight into Hestu's gift. And he said, quote, "We just kind of thought it would be funny to make that a big joke." Later saying that, confirming what people have suspected of Korok seeds, quote, "It's just the backstory, the kind of hidden kind of thing that in the game, thing is in the game the whole way, that Korok seeds are actually Korok poop. So if you spend all this time collecting all 900 Korok seeds, which are actually Korok turds, then you're makes sense that your reward at the end is a giant Korok turd."
Yeah, though, you know, that could have been inferred, should have been inferred from the, just the flavor text surrounding whenever you select or whenever you get a Korok seed. It says something like, you know, this little tiny lump has a very distinctive smell. and they kind of look like a little bit of like the poop emoji, but then, you know, when you get Hestu's gift, which is this shiny, huge one, the flavor text is a gift of friendship given to you by Hestu. It smells pretty bad. So while it doesn't overtly say it's poop, it's poop. But,
900 was a lot of Korok seeds to collect, and didn't feel like much of an achievement once you got Hestu's gift at the end, but that's certainly surpassed by a much larger number and perhaps bigger achievements from a game that was released in May, at the end of May, to the Steam platform called Running Through Russia, because that game was released and had over 4,000 achievements you could unlock in the game.
Yeah, though as a game, I think there was not much to it. It was just kind of an endless runner. And yeah, but like the 4,000 achievements, they'll just sort of like flow in from what I understand. And they get to a point when their names are just like new underscore achievement underscore 127 underscore 26. So it's not like you're actually getting real achievements. It's just sort of like a game which has the most number of achievements, and you're just getting achievements for the sake of getting achievements almost.
pretty much. It seems like it's also taking the piss out of achievements on Steam as well. When one of the reviewers on Steam said of the game, quote, "I got 50 achievements for bumping into a bear each time."
Yeah.
So, yeah, they certainly, the developers of it were certainly having a laugh at the people who are so diehard and ardent about getting all the achievements in games, and said, well, here's an impossible task. But one last big number of video games in 2017, that is 11.5 million, which is the viewership for the 2017 Game Awards. In, I believe, just its fourth year, the award show saw a greater than 200% increase in live streams year on year, which is crazy.
Yes, it is.
Considering last year is when the Game Awards were shown in China for the first time, which has a very large gaming public.
Yeah.
So kudos to Jeff Keighley and everyone in the production team overseeing the Game Awards, because that's pretty damn good, and that's better than, I'm sure, a lot of programs shown on broadcast television.
Absolutely. And then to go to a couple of slightly smaller numbers for a minute before moving on, there was a little bit of fascination surrounding the number 64. No, not Nintendo 64, but Commodore 64, for some strange reason, had a little bit of a resurgence back towards September. A little bit of a bump in news when, in the middle of September, we actually saw a man, for whatever reason, who went by the name 64Jim64 on the internet, made a VR headset for the Commodore 64, as well as a VR game that he made for the Commodore 64 to kind of show it in use, delivering quote unquote true real 8-bit immersion, though I think it was just sort of less VR and more just a 3D, you know, display, because I don't think the Commodore 64 had the processing power to handle, you know, when your head would move around and stuff, but it was still amusing, and we thought that that would be it for Commodore 64 stuff for a while, but no, a couple weeks later, we also learned that there was a mini Commodore 64 console in development by Retro Games, the UK-based company, who is trying to also cash in on the success of the NES Classic and Super Nintendo Classic, like several companies were trying to do.
They were, and they took a different approach, in no small part because they didn't actually have the license to use the Commodore 64 name on this product.
Yes, and that's probably the craziest part about this whole Commodore 64 Mini story, because normally, if you're going to make a re-release of something, you should probably get the rights to that thing to do it.
Otherwise, it just kind of seems like you're skirting around, and it's obvious you're skirting around what it is.
Or you're just a pirate company? You're just releasing a pirate piece of media?
And then it obviously looks like a pirate piece of media. There's something off about it that the consumer can just tell right away that, you know, it looks shady and just not something they would buy.
Yeah.
We also saw the, announcement of the Atari box system as well, from which, you know, whatever entity actually currently holds the intellectual property that is the Atari name, that we saw the announcement of, and then nothing more since, which also seems like a bit of a not on the up and up thing, you know, somewhat in the same vein as the Mini Commodore 64 Classic Edition. Sorry, C64.
Yeah, it's the C64.
But all in attempts to, just make money, because there's a lot of money floating around the world of video games right now. And we saw it in many different corners of the gaming landscape in 2017. And we'll start with some good corners of it, because there was a lot of, charitable action and a lot of charitable fundraising done in the video game community in 2017. This time last year, the Awesome Games Done Quick speedrunning telethon event smashed their previous total. Last year's 2017 event raised $2.2 million for the Prevent Cancer Foundation, which was a whole $1 million more than the 2016 total. And right now, as we are talking, up until Sunday, January 14th, is Awesome Games Done Quick 2018 edition, also raising funds for the Prevent Cancer Foundation. So if you hear this and are then motivated to check out Awesome Games Done Quick, go for it. You totally should, as speedrunners gather together to raise money, speedrunning games, for the Prevent Cancer Foundation, which I'd say is a worthwhile cause, and also $2.2 million. When you manage to raise $1 million more than the year prior, good God.
Absolutely. That's nothing to shake a stick at. That's quite an achievement.
But yet, it was somewhat dwarfed by the money raised by World of Warcraft and its pet sales, which I bother me, but if there's the charitable component to them that raises the amount of money that last year's campaign did, then I'm very okay with it, because last year's pet campaign, charitable pet campaign in World of Warcraft raised $2.5 million, sorry, more than $2.5 million for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah, all through the sales of, you know, their in-game $10 pets. However that works, I'm not sure. I'm not a World of Warcraft player, but you basically get an accoutrement for your character that doesn't do anything other than just looks pretty, but I guess you get to know that you helped contribute money that Blizzard gets to write off as a tax benefit.
This is true. In addition to the in-game pet, there was also a physical plush toy available of Mischief, the in-game pet that was the source of these fundraising sales. That went for $25 as opposed to the $10 digital version. But elsewhere at GuardianCon in Florida in the summertime in late June, fans there managed to raise $1.2 million for the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is pretty impressive considering that they raised $560,000 for the St. Jude's Foundation in 2016. So that's certainly a lot of money going to charity. And then in the Summer Games Done Quick in July, that campaign raised $1.76 million from 30,000 people for Doctors Without Borders. And it did so by allowing people to bid on seemingly everything, especially the last, or one of the last games to be speed run through during the Summer Games Done Quick was Earthbound, and people were bidding kind of crazy amounts to name things in that game.
Yeah. But, yeah, Games Done Quick, they managed to get a third impromptu Games Done Quick campaign in September, back when Hurricane Harvey kind of wreaked havoc on Florida.
Houston, rather.
Houston, sorry. Sorry, there were so many hurricanes last year that I couldn't remember which one was which, but Harvey wreaked havoc on Houston, flooded the hell out of the city, and caused a lot of damage, and James Dunquick managed to raise just over $227,000, almost $228,000 for the Houston Food Bank, which is, of course, good. I mean, James Dunquick, they raise a lot of money for charity, and they do a lot of good work.
They really do, and I think that's one of the brighter lights in the gaming community, really, is the Games Done Quick people. Very well organized, a lot of people involved, just a great community around that event, acting selflessly for the betterment of others through their actions, through their money, through their donations. But it's let's counter that. Let's let's shine a light on some other less savory aspects. Not even sweet nor savory aspects of gaming and just stupid amounts of money in 2017, because as you may recall, there was a period of time where people were obsessed with Szechuan sauce.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of Rick and Morty, the TV show, but one of the unfortunate things about being a fan of Rick and Morty is that you have to kind of distance yourself from the incredibly toxic fan base that has kind of arisen from the show. And toxic, and I just want to say kind of stupid, because, I mean, one of like the, it was just a throwaway joke at the first episode that, you know, Rick mentioned, basically saying that like his white whale is the whole reason why he goes on for anything, is so he could maybe one day possibly taste McDonald's Szechuan chicken McNugget sauce again. It was essentially just, it could have been anything, and he just so happened to say that. It was just essentially like, you know, one of their life is meaningless, I'm just going to pick a random thing and go with it. But for some reason, the Rick and Morty fan base kind of picked it up, and it turned into a huge meme, and it exploded to the point where, you know, there was a joke eBay auction, for a single package of this sauce, that it was just straight up saying that like they found it in their car, or something to that effect. It was equally kind of unappealing. But it's just, bear in mind, a single package of chicken McNugget sauce was selling on eBay, and the auction closed for nearly $15,000.
U.S.
Yes, U.S. dollars.
Yeah, not one of the brighter points in 2017. People are free to spend their money however they see fit, go for it, and also other people are free to judge and criticize how other people spend their money as they see fit. And by God, there are some stupid people.
I mean, furthering the Szechuan sauce thing, Justin Roiland, one of the co-creators of Rick and Morty, actually tweeted out to the head chef of McDonald's, you know, under the Rick and Morty Twitter account, of something to the effect of, hey, can we get some of that Szechuan sauce? And then he tweeted back saying, let's see what I can do, which of course also made the internet go crazy. And he ended up sending a couple of 64-ounce bottles of Szechuan sauce to the Rick and Morty folks.
Indeed, and some of those bottles ended up making their way to eBay over the summertime, and one such bottle in August went for just over $15,000, $15,350 U.S. to be exact, for a 64-ounce bottle of Szechuan sauce. Again, the McDonald's chicken McNugget dipping sauce that was a promotional tie-in with the movie Mulan back in 1998.
Yeah, and for the one that went for $15,000, or $15,350, I should say, they tried to make it seem a little bit more charitable, because in the description they said that 10% of the proceeds were going to Extra Life, and at least another 10% were going to other charities like Able Gamers. So that's 20% of $15,000. It's not the Awesome Games Done Quick amounts, that's for sure.
No, it's certainly not. There's far less virtue in that when you're just making way too much money off a bottle of Szechuan sauce being sold on eBay. But then again, eBay literally is the free market, and if people think something is worth $15,000, be it a packet, be it a full 64-ounce bottle, they will determine and judge that accordingly. But look at the evaluations. A small packet went for just under $15,000, and the full 64-ounce bottle, which I think actually came with one of those Pelican cases, if I recall correctly. I don't know off the top of my head.
I think that's correct, yes.
Which, a Pelican case is a couple $100. That's a sweet piece of carrying gear or just, you know, talking point or whatever, with like the fitted foam and everything for this 64-ounce bottle of Szechuan sauce. And that 64-ounce bottle went for $15,350, just a bit more than the packet.
Yeah.
I'm going to say the evaluation's a bit off. Something doesn't compute there, but then again, $30,000 at least was spent on Szechuan sauce.
On
eBay.
On a very tiny amount of Szechuan sauce for to be enjoyed over not that many Chicken McNuggets? Probably.
Here's the thing. These people who are buying and hoping to get the new bottle of Szechuan sauce, you can't resell that later on and hope to recoup your money. It's because it's tied into the Rick and Morty mania. That will pass. That joke and fervor over the Mulan joke in episode one of last season's Rick and Morty, that's not ever going to be there again. You're not getting your money back. So the only thing you can do at that point is eat the Szechuan sauce to get any sort of value out of it. But what happens if you don't like it?
Yeah.
What happens if it's total garbage?
Now, what happens if you find out that you were being trolled by Rick? Huh? Anyways, but that's not the only showing of unbridled greed that we could talk about. Lots and lots of money was exchanged over, well, non-charitable means by a couple of companies. One a big company, one a small company that is now, I guess, a big company. Yeah. The big company is EA, and they bought Respawn Entertainment, who are the developers of Titanfall, just weeks after EA closed down Visceral Games, to the tune of $455 million.
And that's a lot of money, and I think that was the biggest game company acquisition of 2017. There actually weren't too many in the year that I can recall, that being the biggest one. There was, I believe, news reports that EA had an option to buy Respawn outright if another company or another entity made an offer on them or an attempt to buy Respawn. That happened, so EA triggered their clause and bought the company, which was only 7 years old, founded by Jason Weston and Vince Zampella, who were formerly designers on Call of Duty, and then they had a big fallout with Activision. They got paid for that, and now they got paid for selling Respawn, and good on them, but that's a lot of money. But for $455 million, you're getting an entire company, you are getting intellectual property, you're getting the Titanfall series, you're getting staff, you're getting talented individuals, and hell, likely some real estate as well for offices and things of that nature. There's a lot to justify a $455 million purchase price.
Yeah.
Let's go to later in the year when the small company that's kind of a big company and seems to be, I don't want to say punching above their weight class, because that would certainly convey an image that they're doing something, when we're not sure this small company is doing anything other than just sitting back and letting the money roll in.
Yeah, this small company who is maybe kind of a big company in terms of money now is Cloud Imperium. And Cloud Imperium, if that name doesn't ring a bell, we'll catch you up. They are the ones responsible for Star Citizen. You remember that Kickstarter that was successful back in I guess 2016.
If not before that.
But it was a successfully kickstarted game for $2 million. Where they raised $2 million, and then they took all of their donations offline, and then they just kept getting money. But I guess in 2017 they raised $34.9 more million. And I don't know if that's all donations or if that was donations and in-game purchases that people were making, but they raised more money, which is down from what they raised in 2016, but not much. I mean, they're still making $35 million a year.
True, if you're to average it out, and 2017 was the year that we saw the total amount of money raised between Kickstarter and between the post-Kickstarter funding campaign for Star Citizen. We saw that funding total cross the $175 million threshold.
Yeah.
$175 million has been raised for a game that doesn't exist. That is not officially released.
Yeah, I mean, it exists. It's in demo form / beta form. But, yeah, you can buy 3D models for various things to appear in-game.
That's right, for several thousand dollars in some cases.
Yeah. I think the most, like, we talked about how, like, back in November, about how they were opening up land parcels to be purchased. So for $50 US, you can get 4 kilometer by 4 kilometer parcel of land. For $100, you can get an 8 kilometer by 8 kilometer parcel of land. Of course, where you're responsible for everything on it, including policing it yourself, blah, 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 all of that. And that might seem like a lot for not much, but, yeah, they have, more expensive things that you can buy, like ships. I'm having a harder time finding the truly bananas prices I was seeing before, on some of these ships. Oh, some of these ships are not available anymore on their site. Good, as I'm just clicking through now. Oh, actually, well, yeah, but some of them are still in upwards of $275 for a ship.
And last year, when we were looking at prices on some of these ships, they were in the thousands of dollars. I think one was over 3,000.
It was a huge amount. Like, I want to say there was one that was at least $1,400 for sure. But yeah, these are all amounts essentially just to 3D models that you get to look at in game, basically.
In the beta of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not a full release yet.
Yeah, oh, that's what it was. Yeah, so there's this thing you can buy called the Verse Pack, which is the most expensive thing on their website, which is $795 US. But yeah, just has a few ships in it and a few other things. But yeah, $800 here and there.
Oh, that would, a paltry sum.
That would all add up, I suppose. But yeah, I kind of, you know, wish I was Cloud Imperium Games, because that's bananas.
It's beyond ridiculous at this point to still be raising that amount of money and still have no full release of anything.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Is 2018 the year we see Star Citizen released? To see something released for all that money, or something officially released, you know, not still in development? Because there's no indication this game will ever be out of development.
Yeah. I don't know. I seem to think that it's some sort of scam at this point, but yeah.
But I think that's a nice segue into just a look ahead to some of the games that we know are real, are tangible, and their companies, their makers, their publishers will release to actually recoup some of the development costs because they're not following the crowdfunding structure of things. Unlike Star Citizen, they need to exist and be released for the public to buy them and for the people to make, or the developers to make their money back. I mentioned, and I think we talked about briefly on last week's program, looking ahead to Sony's lineup for 2018, it right now is positioned to be one of the strongest ones, and we can speak just a little bit more in detail about that to give you the full idea of what it's looking like right now. If it comes to pass, Sony will have six very killer apps to come to the PlayStation 4 platform in 2018, and it gets rolling pretty soon because on February 6th will be the release of Shadow of the Colossus, the PlayStation 4 remastering that is being handled by Bluepoint Games, who also did the collection of Ico and Shadow of the Colossus for the PlayStation 3 back in 2011. So they're familiar with the game already, having worked on it, but now they're giving it that whole other level of shine and polish and hopefully upgrade to the engine.
Yeah. Then in March, well, not fully confirmed, but rumored to be March, we're going to see the new God of War released for PS4. It was announced back in December 2014 at the PlayStation Experience and officially shown off back in 2016 at E3, of course, being developed by Sony themselves in the Santa Monica studio. So that should be something to look forward to.
Yes, that's the wholly different take on the God of War franchise. Really a reboot of it, I guess toning down the cartoonish over-the-top nature of it and trying to make it a more gritty, real story with Kratos seeking refuge in Scandinavia, Norway.
Sort of Scandinavian country, yes.
Yeah, to tie into Norse mythology. Yet still have a lot of violence and blood and giant monsters you'll have to kill, but also, you know, it's modern because Kratos has a beard.
Yes. It took him time to grow that beard and he's going to show it off to the world.
Damn right. He earned that beard. Another general release window of spring 2018 is what is currently being given to, the new game being worked on by Quantic Dream, Detroit Become Human. The game where it seems to have, multiple running storylines and characters and narratives, but the one where it's a near future story and you play or can play at one point as an android, an android cop, basically. As there's a seemingly a small uprising in a dystopia in Detroit, in near future Detroit, which looks very interesting, but one that could potentially be the biggest one of all is Last of Us Part 2, which does not have a clear release window yet. If it was to come out in 2018, it would come out in late 2018 and be one of those big fall Christmas titles to really get people out there and spending money on the PlayStation 4 and buying the system. Of course, the new game coming from Naughty Dog to continue the Last of Us story. But another one that a lot of people are looking forward to is Marvel's Spider-Man, the game that was shown off in E3 2016. Took a lot of people by surprise when they learned it was being developed by Insomniac Games, you know, the Ratchet and Clank people, and they made this absolutely killer-looking Spider-Man game, which seems so fluid and really gives you finally the sense of being Spider-Man with all his powers.
Yeah. It looks really,
that one
looks really wide open and cool. But speaking of wide open and cool, another one that people are looking forward to is Shenmue 3, which is, was initially announced back in 2015 at E3, being developed by EaseNet, it's console exclusive to the PlayStation 4, though it's also going to be on PC. And it was supposed to launch back in December of 2017. But that got pushed back to be the second half of 2018, thus adding to the fervor and the anticipation of a lot of people. And that sort of rounds out the big Sony games.
But that's six big titles. Now, there's no guarantee they all release in 2018, and I would not be surprised if some of them, if one or two of them are pushed back to 2019, maybe Shenmue 3 gets pushed back again.
I wouldn't doubt
maybe,
it.
Yeah, maybe Last of Us Part 2 maybe just can't quite make that fall release and instead moves its way into early 2019. Would also not surprise me, but even still, any number of, say, or any order, any collection of three or four of these titles, Shadow of the Colossus, God of War, Detroit Become Human, Last of Us Part 2, Spider-Man, and Shenmue 3, and Sony's got a really killer lineup that we know of for this year, and compare that to, say, some of the other titles that are first-party exclusive to Microsoft and Nintendo, and those other Microsoft and Nintendo games can't really compare, even with this week's mini Nintendo Direct that came out and announced a couple new games coming to the Switch and gave release dates to some other ones, but the lineup of games that we know right now for Nintendo looking to be filled with a lot of low B and C list titles. If we assume and accept that Mario and Zelda are the big AAA absolute pinnacle of Nintendo games, then so far what Nintendo has lined up is not on par with those.
Well, with the exception of the Dark Souls remaster, re-release, for the Switch, which is supposed to be coming out sometime in 2018, yeah, most of them are just re-releases. I mean, of like low, mid, B, C games, like you said. Maybe a couple of almost A titles. But yeah.
I mean, there's Kirby Star Allies, the new four-player Kirby game that's coming out March 16th, a port of Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze from the Wii U with a new mode being added for the Switch version that comes out May 4th. Cool. Springtime, we'll see a new Mario Tennis game called Mario Tennis Aces, which is neat, but okay. A port of Hyrule Warriors from the Wii U. Okay, that's also for spring. And then just general 2018 release windows for the Switch. The new Yoshi game that looks to be more cardboard craft-inspired than, felt and yarn of what we've seen from previous Yoshi games. That's general 2018. A new Fire Emblem game, general 2018. Even Octopath Traveler, which was shown off at the very start during the initial Switch reveal press conference in Japan in January 2017, is still with a general 2018 release window from Square Enix. But if you're looking for ports and crazy over-the-top action...
But also, speaking of Square Enix, too, one of the ones that was also mentioned that a lot of people were actually excited about was the final remix of The World Ends With You, which was initially released 10 years ago for the DS, but it's now being re-released for the Switch, which a lot of people were actually pretty excited for. It was a pretty highly rated game, but again, 10 years old for a, like, mobile console. There were other things announced as well, but Nintendo as well. Bayonetta 2 for February of 2018.
Yes, and at some point there's the third Bayonetta game coming exclusive to the Switch, which is neat, but as of right now, the lineup for 2018 of Switch games, while neat, it's lacking that major killer title that we saw in the first year of the Switch with Zelda and Mario, and Nintendo has to have something up their sleeve and just not shared it yet, or if they don't, that's really going to bite into the momentum of the Switch, wouldn't you think?
Oh, it would, but I wouldn't count out a Metroid title just yet.
True, too. There was the very brief tease of one, Metroid Prime 4 at E3 last year. They could always pull out a full mainline Pokemon game for the Switch as well and just send everybody into a tizzy.
Yep. There's any number of things that Nintendo could and probably will do.
True, too.
It's still a little bit early to tell. I mean, Nintendo's the type of company that does hold their cards pretty close to their chest and doesn't really let a lot of stuff leak necessarily.
And this is true. We will grant that. And they will have other Nintendo Direct videos throughout the course of the year. And over on the Microsoft side, just to round out the big three, what we know of big games for them that are first-party exclusive, Sea of Thieves is set to launch on March 20th. That's the new game from Rare, the online multiplayer pirate one, which actually looks really fun. And also Crackdown 3, which is slated to release sometime in spring of 2018. It's a game that's been in development for a while, and I'm sure the developers feel like it's been in development for a while after it was initially shown off at E3 2014. It was supposed to come out on November 7th last year, which was the launch day for the Xbox One X. It was supposed to be one of those games that would really show off why you need an Xbox One X and what you can do to enhance the visuals of a game and make it look so much better. It didn't. It was pushed back to spring of this year. And it may very well get pushed back again. But if what we know for Nintendo games is a lot of lower tier titles, Microsoft's cupboards are kind of bare at the moment for first party exclusives. That could always change because all they have to do is put Halo or the name Halo on something and becomes a major title at that point.
Yep. But thankfully for everyone, there's third-party titles too. And if you have any of the systems, you could potentially benefit. And there are a fair number of third-party titles to look forward to. As I mentioned previously, Dark Souls Remastered is but one of them. But it's not just exclusive to Switch. That one's going to be on everything. PlayStation 4, Xbox One, PC. But that's, again, not the only title.
No, and that's not coming out until the end of May either, and there's actually a few bigger titles coming out between now and the end of May as well. Hell, there are two big ones coming out at the end of January, too.
Yeah, there's Dragon Ball FighterZ, which is coming out for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One back on January 26th of 2018, and Monster Hunter World coming out on, again, January 26th of 2018 for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. So two highly anticipated games right there.
Both those games, Dragon Ball FighterZ and Monster Hunter World, have a lot of people excited for their release. It seems like the roster of Dragon Ball FighterZ just grows by the week. There's one or two fighters announced for it. You think they would run out of Dragon Ball characters at some point.
But no, there's tons of them, and the animation looks so good for that game. It looks really good.
It genuinely looks like you're finally able to play the anime series.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. So a lot of people are looking forward to that title. Let's go to February 20th because that's a day when a game will release that I don't know how many people are going to be looking forward to it. Because it seems really, really like a cash grab on the franchise. For February 20th is the day that Metal Gear Survive will come out.
Yeah, the first Metal Gear, the first post-Kojima Metal Gear title that doesn't really look like a Metal Gear title. There's aliens and there's weird stuff happening and
wormholes.
Probably didn't need to be called Metal Gear, but they clearly just add the name Metal Gear to add some sort of appeal to have people buy it. But yeah, as you said, February 20th, 2018 for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One.
And if you're a Metal Gear fan, apparently this Survive game is set between the events of Ground Zeroes and Phantom Pain from Metal Gear Solid 5, you know, to further try and tie into the existing Kojima Metal Gear Solid canon, but it's really not going to tie into the canon.
No, it can't. Unless it came from Kojima's brain and is able to be tied in using some crazy long-winded explanation, it's not going to fit. But moving on from Metal Gear, more to a franchise that hasn't had people mad at it yet, is the Far Cry franchise. Far Cry 5 is supposed to be coming out on March 27th of 2018 for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. It's a pretty beloved franchise by Ubisoft.
It is, and this new incarnation of Far Cry 5, that's the one where it is set in America and is very much focused on some crazy backwoods militia cult, or religious militia cult thing in, like, Montana. And I'm really intrigued by it.
Yeah, me too. It looks like it's a very interesting, has a lot of great potential, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I want it to do good. I want it to be well received because, that's one of those games that I would be interested in playing of this generation. But we'll see. It's not often you see a game set in America with a very religious cult leader, and it feels so appropriate to our contemporary times as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But then later in the spring, there's the smaller indie title from Compulsion Games called We Happy Few coming out. That's a really more bizarre, I don't want to say bizarre, but somewhat surreal title. It's set in the 60s, has a bit of a feel for a bit of a BioShock feel to it that I get from the trailers and all the media. Set in the 60s, very much trying to replicate that 60s British mod style, and you're in some weird type of compound where a lot of people are drugged and to all think and believe the same things, and you're basically the one to break out from that. That comes out on the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC, and then some other titles that have less descript release dates but are still penciled in for 2018. One of them, arguably the biggest one, Red Dead Redemption 2, we cannot forget about that.
Nope.
From Rockstar. Was supposed to come out in late 2017, but Rockstar pushed it back, and it's believed to come out in the second quarter, which has some rumors pointing to a June 8th release, though that is certainly not confirmed at this point. But I also wouldn't doubt it gets pushed back maybe a bit further into late summer, early fall. But time will tell, because Rockstar has been really tight-lipped about this game.
Yeah, and if Rockstar is going to be pushing stuff back, you know it's for a good reason. So if Grand Theft Auto V was anything to be referencing here for this, I feel like Red Dead Redemption 2 is probably going to be nothing short of that.
That's true, and Rockstar Games is one of those studios where they give the games the development time they need. They are not rushed whatsoever, and another game that's actually slated for a 2018 release that has seen a lot of development time is Kingdom Hearts 3 from Square Enix, having been initially shown off at E3 2013.
Yeah, it's been in development for quite a while, and people, I mean, it's the launch window is all of 2018, so for all we know, it could possibly even get pushed to 2019 as well. But you know, there's a lot of people to please. There's a lot of rabid Kingdom Hearts fans that that want it to be perfect. So I'm sure Square Enix is going to try to do that. So
that's true, and anything less than perfection would upset a lot of people. Actually, that is a very passionate fan base.
Absolutely.
Elsewhere in the gaming sphere of 2018, we can look forward to Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, the new game from Koji Igarashi, that was funded through crowdfunding means, initially announced back on May 11th of 2015 when the Kickstarter for it went live, raised a pretty substantial amount of money, and went into development not long after that, and was penciled for a late 2017 release, but I think as 2016 and actually 2017 went on, the development team realized it's not going to happen. So they pushed it back and are now pegging it for a release in the first half of 2018. So certainly looking forward to that. Anything in the Metroidvania is certainly worth your attention, and one by one of the major names in that genre and style of games is really doubling the amount of attention you should pay to it.
Absolutely. But moving into, again, late 2018 anticipated release windows, Mega Man 11, which was shown off back in December, going to be released for every system. And I personally thought that the animation looked pretty good. I like the style it's taking. And I hope it gets released soon because I would like to try it.
Indeed. I think especially because Mighty No. 9 was such a disappointment too, that there's still a demand, a need to be satisfied for something like a Mega Man game. And if Mighty No. 9 couldn't do it, then...
then maybe Mega Man should do it.
Yeah, that's true. Gwent at some point this year is going to come out on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and PC.
Even though it's been in beta forever.
Are you still in the beta for that?
Everyone can be in the beta for that if they want. I mean, it's open to download.
Okay.
But yeah, like it's pretty complete. Go in and try it now if you want. Unless they took it off, I could be entirely leading you down the wrong path right now, but I've had the beta for quite some time on my PlayStation, and it's a fun game.
Well, obviously there was enough people who thought it was a fun game in Witcher 3 to warrant CD Projekt Red spinning this off into its own thing, and also then forming its own, you know, esports league around it too, the Gwent Masters Championship Series.
Exactly.
And putting a lot of money in the prize pool for it as well.
Yeah, exactly. But one other final game that I think maybe some older gamers are going to be excited for. I don't know if younger people will be excited for it, but it's a bit of a blast from the past, franchise-wise, to be announced or released sometime in 2018. Which is pushed back from the sometime in 2017 original release window that it had, which is the new Toe Jam and Earl game, Back in the Groove, which will be released again for literally everything, PlayStation 4, Xbox One, Switch, PC, Mac, Linux, everywhere that you can play a game.
Yeah, everywhere except mobile devices, yeah. But that's a whole other... means of developing, so cannot fault them for that, but very much a nostalgia play, and not surprising to see a Kickstarter game have to push back its launch window. As nice as it would be to get the game out, have a quick turnaround after your successful funding campaign, if you were to do that, then you would really risk releasing an inferior product and besmirching your name and also ruining the goodwill you've built up with people from that first successful campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
So between Toe Jam and Earl being pushed back Bloodstained being pushed back as well, I'm okay with these Kickstarter games being delayed. And it's nice that they have ambitious development windows, but let's be honest here. We know it takes time to make a good game, so... maybe be a bit more honest with that up front?
Yeah, exactly. There's no need to lie to people, and lying is not a good foundation of, you know, any sort of business or otherwise relationship. You know, relationships built on lies do not last.
This is true. This is very true, and that is a good mantra for you, the listener, to take with you into the year of 2018 as we wind down and wrap up our second part of 2017 year in review. We have now thoroughly reviewed, vetted, examined, and reminisced about all corners, facets, and aspects of the past 12 months in the world of video games. And next week, we'll get back to business as usual, catching up on the latest and greatest gaming news that there is to offer. And we look forward to bringing that to you, and we look forward to you joining us to share in it all. So we shall bid you adieu for now and say until next week. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you.